adding that feeling to the village's isolation and its spectacular view, he even gave it a name. The Overlook Hotel, he called it. Then the men inside the dome found the first charred body, or at least what was left of it. They established that it was a woman, and though they had no evidence, they were certain that deeper down they would find two more dead, one Japanese and one Dutch. What sort of kidnapper dumped the uptake into a lime-filled pit without even making a ransom demand? Beside the body, deep in a chemical sludge, they found what was left, barely 2 inches square of what looked like a saddle blanket. They didn't know it, but on the last night of her life, the woman had clutched it to her face and tried to asphyxiate herself to stop the relentless flood of pain. As a result, it contained her saliva, blood, strands of tissue, and a complete panel of genetic material from the blisters that had formed in her mouth and throat. The blanket was still locked in her partly burnt hand, protecting it from the worst of the flames, when the Saracen used the horses to drag her into the pit. Another hour, and the quicklime would have destroyed it completely. Worried now, and forced to acknowledge it might not be a kidnapping at all, instantly rehabilitating Keating's reputation and career prospects, the NBC team and their supervisors greatly accelerated the work rate. Their first task was to discover exactly what they were dealing with, so they sealed the small square of blanket into an airtight biohazard container, secured it within another lead receptacle, and sent it, first by helicopter and then on a special overnight jet, to Fort Detrick in Maryland. Chapter 43. Fort Detrick, part of the United States Army Medical Command, is made up of a collection of buildings and campuses set on 1,200 high-security acres just outside the town of Frederick. One of the largest of the campuses houses the nation's leading biological warfare agency, the Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, an organization so steeped in secrecy that a number of conspiracy theorists have claimed that it was the lab where the government created HIV. If they were right, perhaps the long, low building not far from what used to be known as Anthrax Tower was also where NASA staged the moon landing. Nobody knows because very few people, not even those with security clearances as high as mine, have ever been allowed onto the site. It was at one of the facility's biosafety labs that the sealed box from Afghanistan arrived on a Sunday morning. Because nobody at the Overlook Hotel knew what they were dealing with, it hadn't been marked as top priority. For that reason, it was placed in a queue and wasn't opened until just after 9 p.m. By then, the only microbiologist working was a guy in his 40s called Walter Drax, a petty, resentful man who was happy to work the graveyard shift because it meant he didn't have to put up with what he called the assholes and knuckle-draggers. In his mind, the ANKs were a large cohort, one that included most of his co-workers and certainly everyone in management, the people who, he believed, had blocked every possibility of promotion and the higher pay it provided. Working alone under what are called biosafety level 4 conditions, in a lab kept at negative air pressure, wearing a suit not dissimilar to the Saracens, his air regulator connected to an overhead supply, he unsealed the box in a special cabinet, removed the small piece of saddlecloth, and prepared it for analysis. Peering at the screen of his electron microscope, he couldn't believe what he was seeing. Heart racing, sweating hard inside the biosafety suit, he checked it 3 times, even changing out the microscope and going back to his workstation and consulting the relevant literature and the Institute's classified manuals, before he was convinced. He was looking at variola major. Instinctively, he knew that it was a very hot strain, but what really terrified him was what he saw when he looked deep into the knot of DNA at the center of it. It had been genetically engineered. He had no doubt that it was a weaponized military strain of the pathogen, a no-holds-barred weapon of mass destruction. By unpicking the DNA knot and comparing the images in the manuals with what he could see through the microscope, he quickly learned that somebody had inserted a specific gene into it. There was only one reason he could think of why somebody would do that. The virus had been constructed to be vaccine evasive. If it worked, and Drax could see no reason why it wouldn't, nobody in the world, not even the Nazis with their cattle cars and canisters of Zyklon B gas, would ever have been in possession of a more efficient killer. The normal procedure in such an event, if anything in such circumstances could ever be considered normal, was for Drax to phone his duty supervisor at home and inform him of what he had found. But Drax didn't want to do that. He was damned if he was going to give any of the A and K's a place in the Institute's history, that celebrityhood that he knew the discovery of weaponized smallpox would entail. I mean, he told himself, the whole place still talks about the guys who found the Ebola virus in a damn monkey. Instead, he decided to make an end run around the mall and speak to his cousin. He didn't like her much either, but she was married to a special assistant at the National Security Council, a man who Drax privately called Lip Gloss, given how smooth he was at sucking up to his superiors. When he got him on the line, Drax, without explaining anything about the small square saddle blanket, said he needed to speak to the highest-ranking member of the U.S. intelligence community he could contact this late on a Sunday night. Lip Gloss laughed and said things didn't work that way and he'd better tell him what it was all about and, anyway, what was wrong with his own superiors and surely they had a protocol in place. Drax wasn't in any mood for delay.
"Oh, sorry," he said. "Perhaps you need some directions to Shut Up Village. There's a secure line directly into the lab. Now do it. Get somebody to call me. It's a national emergency."
He hung up before Lip Gloss could reply and then sat down to wait. He hadn't felt so good in years. It was the phrase national emergency and the fact that Drax worked for the preeminent biodefense laboratory which convinced Lip Gloss to call the deputy director of national intelligence, a man whom he knew well because their teenage sons played baseball on the same team. As a result, it was the deputy director who called Drax and listened with avalanching dismay as the technician told him about the piece of material that had arrived from Afghanistan and the different types of smallpox.
"Given the panic something like this would cause, I wanted as few people as possible to know. I thought it best to try and go straight to the top," Drax told him.
The deputy director congratulated him on his foresight, told him to speak to nobody and to sit tight until he called back. The deputy director, however, had one immediate and overwhelming problem. Was Drax telling the truth? Hadn't it been a scientist in the same unit of Fort Detrick who had been suspected of manufacturing anthrax and sending it through the post to several U.S. senators? On the other hand, while the guy he had been speaking to on the secure line certainly sounded like a nightmare, that didn't necessarily mean he was a Fort Detrick nutjob. He called the head of the Institute, a high-ranking military officer and a well-respected scientist in his own right, swore him to secrecy, explained what he had been told and asked him, no, ordered him, to get to the lab immediately to confirm the provenance of the sample and examine Drax's findings. 40 minutes later, sitting in front of Drax's electron microscope, the head of the Institute called back and gave the deputy director the news the guy had been dreading. Now the machinery of government and the sense of panic started to go into overdrive. All that occurred while only two people at the nation's huge biodefense facility, the organization that should have been at the epicenter of events, had any idea what was actually happening. As far as end runs went, it was spectacular. For the rest of us, it was fortuitous. It meant the government at least had a chance of keeping the situation secret. If the Saracen were to learn he was being hunted, he would either go to ground immediately or accelerate his plans. Maintaining secrecy was paramount, and in that regard, the next few hours would be critical. Chapter 44. The Secret Held. By midnight on that Sunday night, only 9 people in the world, apart from the Saracen, knew the truth. A short time later, even though I had long ago surrendered my badge, I became the 10th. The first 2 initiates, Drax and his boss, were at the Army's Research Institute of Infectious Diseases. The third was the Deputy Director of National Intelligence. Once he had confirmed the truth of what he had been told, he made an urgent phone call, and the head of his department, the Director of National Intelligence, became the 4th. The director, no great bureaucrat, was steeped in the history and practice of the sprawling intelligence community. He had started his career at the National Security Agency, analyzing photos of Soviet military installations taken by U-2 overflights, and had then moved into covert operations with the CIA. Thanks to his dark history of targeted killings in that section, and the fact that he was the most softly spoken person ever to work in Washington, he was given a nickname, which had followed him throughout his storied career. Whispering Death was what they called him. He phoned the president, asleep in his bedroom in the family quarters on the second floor of the White House, and waited a moment while the commander-in-chief shook the sleep out of his brain and moved into the study next door. It was past 11 p.m. by then. The president had been widowed for the past 7 years, and he didn't move into the adjoining room for fear of waking anyone. He had lived a monastic life since his wife had passed, and he slept alone. No, he wanted to buy himself a little time to grab a robe from the back of the door. He could tell from the time of the call and the tone of Whispering Death's voice that something huge had happened, and he didn't want the damn New York Times reporting that he was lying in bed in his underpants when he heard. Sitting at his desk, the president listened as Whisperer told him that a sample of live smallpox had been recovered from an abandoned village in Afghanistan. That it wasn't just ordinary smallpox, it appeared to have been engineered to crash through the vaccine. That the genetic analysis indicated it had been made from individual components that were readily available throughout the world. That the virus appeared to have undergone a dry gulch clinical trial in the Hindu Kush Mountains. That 3 innocent people were dead. And the only suspect, a person who nobody knew anything about, had escaped and undoubtedly vanished into one of the nearby Arab nations, which had a combined population of about 400 million people. In short, they were facing a potential catastrophe. It was in those circumstances that the president, who was very pleased he had put on his robe, became the 5th person to know the secret. Neither he nor the Director of Intelligence had any doubt, not then or in any of the weeks that followed, that America was the target. With a sinking heart and growing anger, the President asked the Director how long he thought they had before an attack was launched.
"I don't know," Whispering Death replied. "All I can tell you is that somebody, or some group, appears to have synthesized it, and now has good reason to believe that it works. Why would they delay?"
"I understand," the president said coldly, "but you're the director of national intelligence. I need some sort of time frame, a best guess, anything."
"How would I know? Damn soon, that's all I can say."
It was a small blessing that the White House recording system extended to the president's private study. It meant that there was now a historical record of the only time Whispering Death had ever been known to raise his voice. He told the president he was about to call for a car and would be at the White House in 20 minutes. He rang off and sat in contemplation for a moment. In the long silence of his fear, he couldn't help thinking that Fort Detrick had once again lived up to its nickname. Fort Doom. Chapter 45. As the government car sped through the deserted streets towards the White House, Whispering Death sat in the secure cocoon at the back, the thick glass privacy screen raised, and made a series of phone calls. The first one was to order the immediate arrest of Walter Drax. Even the most cursory glance at the guy's human resources file showed he was a man with too much anger, a loose cannon who could never be trusted not to talk or boast. A few minutes later, 6 men in 3 black SUVs gained access to the Institute's campus, were met by several of the on-site security guards, and walked into Drax's lab. With pistols clearly visible under their jackets, they told the Institute's director to return to his office, flash Drax some IDs which may or may not have been genuine FBI shields, and told him he was under arrest on suspicion of espionage. Drax, looking completely flustered, told them he had no idea what they were talking about. He was a loyal American, had been all his life. They ignored him, read him his rights, and when he asked to see a lawyer, told him that would be arranged once he had been formally charged. Of course, they had no intention of doing that. Instead, they took him to an airfield just the other side of Frederick, where a waiting government jet flew them to a private airstrip in the Black Hills of South Dakota. From there, more government SUVs transported him to a remote ranch house and the bleak rooms it contained. Ironically, in one of those strange coincidences that life sometimes throws up, it was the same house that I had been taken to after I had killed the Rider of the Blue, appropriated and put to a similar use by other members of the intelligence community after the division was disbanded. Like myself so many years before, Drax and his secret were now lost to the world. The second phone call Whisperer made well, actually it was 3 phone calls, was to the ambassadors of Italy, Japan, and Holland. He told them with deep regret that he had just learned that their nationals were dead, killed by their kidnappers when they realized troops were closing in.
"They made a hurried attempt to bury the bodies, and we are exhuming the site now," he said. "Obviously, forensic tests and formal identification will take some time."
He told them that, for operational reasons, the information had to be kept secret, and while he didn't say so explicitly, he gave the impression that a hot pursuit was still in progress. His last call was to the head of the CIA. Offering no explanation, which wasn't uncommon in the shadow world, he told him to organize to have the men in the NBC suits at the Overlook Hotel informed that all tests had come back negative. Because they were no longer needed, they were to return to base immediately. Only after they had left were the CIA's own operatives to move in, seal the pit, and secure the site completely. By the time he had finished the phone calls, plugging the most obvious means by which the secret might escape, he had entered the gates of the White House. Chapter 46. The surprising thing about James Grosvenor was that he was highly intelligent, personable, and modest. In other words, a man far removed from the typical politician. Nobody had intended, least of all himself, that he would ever become the President of the United States. He had been a businessman for nearly all his working life, the major part of it spent taking over distressed manufacturing companies and turning them around. Call him old-fashioned, but he believed in American industry, the skill of American workers, and that hard-working men and women deserved a living wage and decent health care. One thing he didn't believe in was unions. If capital conducted itself properly, there was no need for them. Needless to say, his employees repaid him with their loyalty, and their productivity rates were always among the highest in the country. The success and the wealth that followed his approach allowed him to take over ever larger enterprises and gave him a media profile as a man committed to saving the nation's industrial base. Phoenix Rising was the name given to the segment about him on 60 Minutes. Shortly after it appeared, he was offered the job of Secretary of Commerce, and having enough money and happy to take on a new challenge, he accepted. For a self-made man, government administration and its endless bureaucracy was a revelation. But he was not a man for turning, and he made such a success of it that when the Secretary of Health was swept aside in a corruption scandal, he moved to that department. His wife had died from breast cancer, and he brought to the department a fierce commitment that hadn't been seen for years in the musty building on Independence Avenue. He was widely seen as championing the rights of ordinary citizens, much to the anger of the powerful healthcare lobby, and that only served to raise his public profile even higher. 2 years later, he was asked to take the second slot on a presidential ticket. The candidate was a woman, the first ever to stand for the highest office on behalf of a major party, and Grosvenor knew that he had been selected to balance the ticket with a strong male presence. None of his friends expected him to accept, but he and Anne had never had any kids, and he found it harder and harder to fill the hole left by her passing. His answer was to work harder and find even greater challenges. Beneath the energetic exterior, he was a sad man, and a decent one too. After 2 days' careful thought, he accepted, but in the private counsels of his own mind, he didn't give himself or the candidate much chance of prevailing. Nor did the polls. The country had already elected a black president, but accepting a woman as commander-in-chief just seemed to bridge too far at that stage of the country's evolution. Then, while speaking at a rally in Iowa 10 weeks before the election, the candidate suffered a brain aneurysm. If the images of her crumpling to the stage and suffering a grand seizure weren't bad enough, the next 4 days as she lingered on life support while her family kept a bedside vigil were even worse. Throughout it all, Grosvenor maintained not only his own schedule, but undertook the majority of her engagements too, virtually single-handedly keeping the campaign alive. At every opportunity, he spoke of how he had handled his own wife's illness, and reminded the audience of what was really important in all their lives: good health, long life, the love of others. For once in a political campaign, it sounded genuine. He had always been witty, a kind of twinkly, handsome man, and the polls tightened. But the real turning point came on the night the family decided to take the candidate off life support. Grosvenor was at the hospital, and after it was all over, he stepped outside a side door to get some air. Moments later, the candidate's husband joined him, both of them thinking they were completely unobserved. But somebody was watching, a hospital worker probably, and whoever it was captured the scene on a cell phone camera. Grainy, recorded at a substantial distance, it was an indistinct video but certainly clear enough to see the candidate's husband break down and start to cry. After a pause, when it was clear the man couldn't master his emotions, Grosvenor reached out, put his arms around the man, and held him close for several minutes. Two men, neither of them young, standing outside a hospital, one of them a candidate for vice president and supporting the other in his time of anguish, was such a human, unscripted moment that minutes after the anonymous camera person uploaded it on the internet, it went viral. For the duration of the film clip, the electorate saw behind the curtain of image and spin, and what they recognized in the man who stepped to the front of the ticket was, I believe, a person not too different from themselves. On the first Tuesday in November, it wasn't a landslide, but Grosvenor, perhaps the most unlikely candidate in modern American politics, won enough to get him over the line.
I'm Lyndon Johnson, without the assassination, he told friends just before the inauguration.
But the one question nobody could answer, the one completely hammered by his opponent during the campaign, was whether James Balthasar Grosvenor had the steel necessary to handle a full-on crisis. All of us, the nation, the world, the man himself, were about to find out. Chapter 47. Whispering Death entered the Oval Office to find that the Secretaries of State, Defense, and Homeland Security had been summoned and were already seated in front of the Lincoln desk. President Grosvenor's chief of staff was taking notes and using a small MP3 player to record what was said. Whether it was for posterity, his autobiography, or to boost his memory, nobody seemed quite sure. The bare bones of the situation had already been explained to the three secretaries by the president, and that now made nine people privy to the secret. With the core of the government assembled, Grosvenor told them that there would be no greater act of treason than for any of them to divulge the threat that now confronted the nation. That meant to their wives, their children, their mistresses, page boys, or anybody else they damn well cared to name. They nodded their heads gravely, and Grosvenor just hoped it was genuine. He was about to launch into a hastily handwritten agenda when the Secretary of Defense interrupted.
In light of what we know, wouldn't it be a good idea if we started with a reading from Scripture or a short prayer?
Grosvenor saw Whispering Death and the Secretary of State raise their eyes to heaven, and realized that he had at least two atheists in the kitchen cabinet.
It's a fine idea, Hal,
he replied evenly to the defense secretary,
and I'm sure all of us will ask privately for whatever spiritual help we need as the night wears on. For the moment, let's keep going, shall we?
It was a good, diplomatic answer, and it seemed to satisfy both Hal Enderby, the Secretary of Defense, and the atheist sitting behind him. The president turned to Whisperer.
First, are we certain that the virus has been designed to try to crash through the vaccine?
Yes, replied Whisperer. There's one gene, apparently associated with the immune system, that has been grafted onto its DNA. There is no way it's a random occurrence.
Will it work? Could it defeat the vaccine? The president asked. I mean, this is way out on the frontier. It's never been done before, has it?
Unfortunately, sir, that's not true,
replied Whisperer, looking around, letting everyone know with his eyes that what he was about to say was highly classified.
During the late 1980s, the Soviets had at least 10 tons of smallpox, which they had developed for use in MIRV warheads. According to a highly placed asset of ours, that material had been engineered to be vaccine evasive. I think we have every reason to believe it is possible.
The revelation by the country's leading spook cast an instant pall over the room, broken only by the sole woman in the meeting, the Secretary of Homeland Security.
But that doesn't mean this version works. The Russians are one thing, terrorists are completely different. We have no way of knowing, do we?
She said.
I think we know, President Grosvenor said. The man in the Hindu Kush had 3 prisoners. It's inconceivable his experiment didn't include vaccinating one of them and testing to see if the virus broke through.
That's my reading, Whisperer agreed. Obviously it worked. All the prisoners are dead.
It means we have no line of defense, said the president. 300 million doses of vaccine are probably useless.
Silence filled the dimly lit room.
We should have developed an antiviral drug, a cure. That's the only real security,
Grosvenor said, almost to himself.
That door's closed. There's no time now.
The Secretary of State, an older man who already looked exhausted, responded.
Grosvenor nodded and turned to Whisperer.
And this is what they call a hot virus?
Very hot, Whisperer said. I believe that was deliberate, too. The hotter the strain, the faster it burns out. A virus isn't exactly alive, he continued, but it's certainly not dead. It can't live outside the host, in this case, the human body. The faster it destroys the host, the faster the epidemic wanes. I don't believe whoever developed this wants to destroy the world. Just us.
That's comforting,
the president said ironically.
Okay, the man that got away, how do we find him?
He turned to the chief of staff.
Echelon?
Within 5 minutes, the chief of staff had made the phone calls that would deliver to the Oval Office everything that Echelon had overheard. To keep the amount of material manageable, Whisperer had suggested restricting the initial pull to a wide arc surrounding the mountaintop in the Hindu Kush over the last 12 days. Even so, he knew that the volume of data would be staggering. There were no landlines in the area, of course, and cellular masts outside Kabul and a few other major cities were non-existent, so that meant satellite phones. While Echelon loved them, it was one of the easier signals in the world to vacuum up. The problem was that the Stone Age nature of all other communications in Afghanistan meant that everyone carried one. Drug traffickers, arms smugglers, warlords, Taliban commanders, aid workers, journalists, village headmen, doctors, and traveling government officials were all equipped with them. Add to that 10 different local languages and over 40 dialects, to say nothing of codes and encryption which ranged from the rudimentary to the sophisticated, and it made the amount of material overwhelming. Nevertheless, if the lone man who Lieutenant Keating had glimpsed on the mountaintop had used a satellite phone anywhere near the village, Echelon would have heard and recorded it. Of course, the president knew there was no guarantee that the man even had a satellite phone, but in the present circumstances, he had little choice. When you don't have anything else, you go with what you got. Responding to a direct order from the president, the water-cooled IBM Roadrunner computers at Fort Meade, among the fastest processing clusters in the world, immediately started scanning their databases. If they found nothing on the first pull, their circle of search would extend out mile by mile until it covered not just countries, but subcontinents. Literally, they were looking for a single voice among tens of millions. Chapter 48. In the meantime, the 5 men and 1 woman seated around the Lincoln desk tried to develop the outline of a plan. Almost immediately, they were at war among themselves. The only thing they agreed on was that there should be no change to the nation's threat status. It was at a low level, and in order to avoid panic and unwanted questions, it had to stay there. But in the 2 hours that followed, the atheists and the God-botherers took to each other's throats on almost every idea, then suddenly teamed up against the president on several others, split among themselves, formed uneasy alliances with their former opponents, returned to their natural alliances, and then sallied forth on several occasions as lone gunslingers.
It's worse than a meeting of the Loya Jirga, the chief of staff said quietly into his MP3 player.
The Loya Jirga was the grand assembly of all the Afghan elders. The reason it was called that was because the word clusterfuck had already been taken. By the time exhaustion was creeping in, everybody had lined up against Whisperer, who, they all thought privately, was the most obstinate man they had ever met.
Oh, get your hand off your dick,
the Homeland Secretary told him in exasperation at one point. It was so unladylike, such an unchristian turn of phrase, even she was shocked that she had said it. Then Whisperer laughed, good man that he was, and everybody else joined in. As a result, they were all in a better mood when Whisperer suddenly came up with the first genuinely good idea. He was the one who thought up Polonium-210. The reason why they had all found him so obstinate was that he refused to move forward on any suggestion until somebody could explain to him how you could launch a worldwide dragnet for a man without revealing why you wanted him.
So, we go to the Pakistanis and say we desperately need your help, but sorry, we won't tell you the reason, he said. Not only will they be offended, but it will lead to speculation, and in my experience, when enough people speculate, somebody always gets it right.
Later on, after they had all finished laughing at the Homeland Secretary's brain snap, Whisperer was taking them through the problem yet again.
We're talking about using the resources of the entire U.S. intelligence community and its allies. That's over 100,000 people chasing one man. Everybody's going to assume it's a terrorist. And what are we going to say?
His voice trailed away as his mind, running ahead of his voice, hit an unseen ramp and launched into clean air. The president looked at him.
What's the matter?
Whisper smiled at them.
What we are going to say is that we have highly credible intelligence that the kidnapping of the foreign nationals was part of a much larger plot. It was to raise money in order to try to acquire a gram of Polonium-210.
A nuclear trigger?
The Secretary of State said.
That's right, explained Whisperer. We'll say that either the man or the organization he's part of are in the final stages of building a suitcase nuclear device.
As the idea sank in, the others looked like cavemen who had just discovered fire.
Everybody will help, the Secretary of Defense said. There's not a country in the world, not even the lunatic fringe, who wants someone building a dirty bomb in their backyard.
It will give us a reason to launch the biggest manhunt in history, Whisperer replied. It's so serious, nobody will question it. Who'd make up something like that? Of course, we'll act reluctant even to reveal it.
But we'll leak it ourselves, the Homeland Secretary added. Something reputable. The Times or the Post.
Whispering Death smiled. Now they were getting the idea.
It'll cause panic,
the Chief of Staff said, making sure that his sensible counsel was loud enough for the recorder.
Sure it will, but not as much as smallpox, Whisperer responded.
He had already thought of the public reaction and didn't believe it was a deal-breaker.
It's one bomb, one city. The President can assure the public we have the resources to stop it.
Everybody turned to the Commander-in-Chief to see his reaction and were surprised to find that the sadness on his face was even more pronounced than usual.
It's a terrible commentary on our times, he said, when a suitcase nuclear bomb is more palatable than the truth.
They weren't stupid people, none of them, and it gave them all pause to think. Where did it start? They must have wondered. How did the world ever get this crazy? But Whispering Death was a practical man, the toughest of any of them, and he didn't believe there was any profit in spending too long reflecting on man's enmity to man.
It means we can cover the airports and borders with agents and arm them with scanning devices. It won't matter what we call them, Geiger counters or whatever, as long as they read body temperature. That's one of the first signs of infection with smallpox. Naturally, we'll pay close attention to Arabs or Muslims. So what if it's profiling? Anyone with an elevated temperature will be directed to secondary screening and quarantine if necessary.
The Secretary of State interrupted.
Is that the most likely method of attack? People deliberately...
Suicide infectees, Whisperer said, picking up the thread. Several years ago, we ran an exercise called Dark Winter, and that's always been the favorite hypothesis. If we can nail one of the vectors, then track it back, reverse engineer their movements, we'll find the people responsible.
There was silence, but Whisperer knew it was the silence of success, not disappointment. It had taken hours, but now they had a workable strategy. In the circumstances, it was an excellent plan, and they couldn't be faulted for the fact that their faces were showing a small flush of hope and confidence. It was just a pity it didn't have a chance of working. First, no matter how many agents were put on the case, there was only a handful of people who knew of the Saracens' movements, and they certainly weren't disposed to help anybody. When Lord Abdul Muhammad Khan heard that all hell was breaking loose, and that the Pakistanis, the Afghans, and even for shit's sake the Iranian government, were searching for a man who had been traveling through the Hindu Kush and was supposedly trying to acquire a nuclear trigger, he couldn't be sure it had anything to do with the doctor who had once been such a fiend with a blowpipe. But, just to be on the safe side, he sent a courier, one of his grandsons so he could be trusted completely, with a verbal message to the Iranian kidnappers. The content was simple. It told them, on their mother's life, that he expected them not to say anything about what they had done for him in grabbing the three foreigners. The message back was just as simple. On their mother's life, their lips were sealed. The second problem was that the people in the White House believed in the weight of numbers. They believed in agents at every airport. They believed in scanners and elevated body temperature. They believed, like an article of faith, in suicide infectees as vectors. The Saracen, however, didn't. And, in view of the fact that he was the one with the smallpox, that was a critical distinction. Dawn was touching the horizon, and the Secretary of State had just asked if they could get some food sent in, when they heard from Echelon. Chapter 49. Two phone calls. The first pull from Echelon had produced two satellite calls, and both of them fitted the search criteria better than anyone could have expected. Made 3 days apart, both of them were slam dunk in the designated time frame, and although there had been a fair amount of atmospheric interference, probably another storm moving through the Hindu Kush or that damned wind blowing all the way to China, the NSA analysts who had handled the high-priority search for the White House were certain they had been made within a few miles of the ruined village. It was quite possible they were made from within the village, but that level of precision would have to wait for the IBM Roadrunners to try to determine the exact coordinates by filtering out the interference. In addition, the two people on the line, the man in the Hindu Kush and a woman at a public phone box in southern Turkey, were both speaking English, although it wasn't their native tongue. The president and Whisper, listening to the chief of staff's report, looked at one another, and their expressions said what the three cabinet secretaries were thinking. Could it get any better than this? Then their luck ran out. The two people on the phone might have been using English, but it didn't help much. On the first call, the man said very little. It was as if he was listening to a report. While the woman did nearly all of the talking, she was very smart. She had pre-recorded it, probably on a cell phone. What she had to say was culled from the BBC, CNN, MSNBC, and a host of other English-speaking TV news services. Although she interrupted her recording a couple of times and offered what seemed to be additional information, it was impossible to get an idea of her age, level of education, or anything else that FBI profilers might have been able to use. The actual content of this weird conversation was even more mysterious. Half of it was in coded words which clearly didn't match whatever the other content was. The expert analysts who had reviewed it were of the opinion that she was giving information about a medical problem, but that in itself was probably code for something else. The second call was even shorter. Again, she had pre-recorded it, and it seemed like some sort of update. The man thanked her, and even across the passage of time in so many miles, you could hear the relief in his voice. He spoke for 6 uninterrupted seconds, then rang off. The people in the Oval Office were totally perplexed. What had started with so much promise a few minutes before had now turned into a labyrinth of problems. The chief of staff glanced again at the report, which had been emailed over, and told them that Echelon had searched its entire database for the last 6 years to see if the sat phone had been used to make or receive any other calls. There was nothing. Just the two phone calls, like single atoms drifting in cyberspace. Virtually incomprehensible. And yet, even in the mess of code and voices borrowed from news programs, there were clues. 4 words, mistakenly spoken by the woman at one point, were in Arabic, and the man cut her off harshly in the same language, admonishing her for using it. So they were Arabs. Or, maybe, that was a rehearsed, deliberate mistake to make anybody who was listening leap to a certain and wrong conclusion. There was another clue. In the background at the Turkish end of the conversation, the thrum of roaring traffic almost drowned out the sound of Muzak, or a radio station, or something. But not quite. There was what sounded like music, and the analyst figured it had been transmitted down the phone line as the woman played her recording into the mouthpiece. What it was, however, they couldn't tell. Their report said they would have to drill down for weeks to try to get an answer from what they had recovered. Normally, such background noise wouldn't have mattered. Echelon would have been able to identify the location of the phone box within moments. But the Turkish phone system was far from normal. Whoever at Echelon had designed the software that worked as a thief at a country's regional telephone hubs didn't count on shoddy workmanship, illegal connections, undocumented repairs, mysterious rewiring to avoid being charged, epidemic corruption, and constant technical failures. All that Echelon could do was narrow the phone box down to the center of a small city. Somewhere, inside a 5-mile radius, a woman had received 2 phone calls, the report said, as traffic passed by and some sort of music played in the background.
"What about voice recognition?"
the president asked, focusing on Echelon's most highly classified capability. His voice sounded even more fatigued than he looked.
"The woman didn't speak long enough in one stretch to get a sample," the chief of staff said, looking further down the report.
He turned to the 3 secretaries, knowing they had never been admitted into Echelon's innermost secrets.
"The system needs at least 6 seconds. It then compares elements of a voice to over 200 million other voices, terrorists, criminals, guerrillas, from information gathered from databases throughout the world," he said, warming to the subject. He'd always loved technology.
"But that's just the start. The real game-changer is it can break down each vowel and sound into a digital..."
"That's enough,"
Whisperer interrupted, his eyes telling the chief of staff that one more word and, under the provisions of the National Security Act, he would be allowed to get up and throttle him.
"What about the man?"
he asked.
"Did they get 6 seconds of him talking?"
"Yeah, they got a good enough sample from him," the chief of staff said, still smarting from being slapped down by the Director of National Intelligence.
"But there was no match. There wasn't even a subset of voices he was close to, not in English or Arabic. It says here, completely unknown to any intelligence or law enforcement database."
The development scared Whisperer deeply. He didn't tell the president or the others, but the one thing which no intelligence agency in the world could deal with was a clean skin. Where did you start with a person who had no history, no form, no record? Whisperer had never met one in his life. Not a genuine one, and he had never wanted to. The others noticed the anxiety in his somber face, and in the short, awkward silence that followed, they realized that their luck wasn't coming back. The president was the first to pull himself together and exercise the leadership they needed. He told them that, for all their hours of frustration and cratered hope, one thing remained true. There was a woman in southern Turkey who knew the man's identity and had spoken to him. She had given him information which, it seemed, was very important. Why else would he, in the middle of testing a virus he had synthesized, a remarkable achievement, have gone to the trouble of calling her? Not once, but twice. Anybody smart enough to engineer a deadly virus must have known there was a risk somebody would be listening. Why did he do it? What was so important? More importantly, who was the woman?
"So, we go to Turkey," he said in conclusion. "How?"
Of course, the Secretaries of Defense, Homeland, and State, the Gang of Three was what Whisperer had started calling them in his head, were all for sending in the Fifth Army and the Mediterranean Fleet and storming the beaches. 100,000 agents wouldn't be enough for what they had in mind. The president calmed them down.
"We've caught a glimpse of somebody," he said. "If we charge in, if we flood the zone, she'll take fright and head for Syria, Saudi, Yemen, you name it, some hole we might never be able to dig her out of."
He had read about the mistake George Bush had made when they were chasing Osama bin Laden, and he had flooded the zone in Tora Bora. The number of people on the ground and the depth of agency infighting ended up undermining the operation completely. Eventually, they got him by good old-fashioned intelligence work.
What do you say, Whisperer?
On the money. The effectiveness of any operation is in inverse proportion to the number of people used,
he said, ready to go to war with a gang of three if he had to.
It's the type of work covert agents do, the best of them anyway. We send in a pathfinder, and if he's good enough, and our luck comes back, he'll find out enough to light the way for the rest of us.
The gang of three said nothing, probably still dreaming of massive bombing runs and the opening scenes of Saving Private Ryan.
Who do we send?
The president asked.
I don't know, Whisperer replied,
and that was why the president respected him so much. He was one of the few people in Washington willing to admit he didn't know something.
I'll come back to you.
The same thought ran through all their heads. One man, that was all, a pathfinder alone in a strange country. Not a job for a man afraid of cracking, for someone who had never learned to dance. The six people in the Oval Office decided there was little more they could do while they waited for Whisperer. The man himself stood up and deftly scooped up the copy of the Echelon report the chief of staff had put on the coffee table. He didn't want that left lying around. As the keepers of the great secret headed for the door, one last thought occurred to the president, and he called out to Whisper.
Where exactly in Turkey are we talking about?
Whisper leafed through the pages of Echelon's report.
A province called Mukla, he replied. The name of the town is Bodrum.
Chapter 50. Whisper didn't shower, didn't eat, didn't rest. He called ahead from his car to have every current government file on southern Turkey downloaded and on his office computer by the time he got there. He wanted to know as much about the area before he even thought about which agency, let alone which operative, he was going to tap as the pathfinder. Hence, immediately after arriving from the White House, he spent the morning shut inside his large office with the blinds drawn and the door closed, hunched over his screen. He had just finished a State Department analysis of Turkey's current political situation, another 10 pages of fellatio, he thought to himself, and picked up a thin file which had been sent to the U.S. Embassy in Ankara, the country's capital. It was from a homicide detective in the NYPD, and it was asking for help in discovering the names of all female U.S. citizens who had applied for Turkish visas in the last 6 months. Whisper didn't know it, but Ben Bradley had come up with the idea. A good idea, too, that somebody who had a Turkish phone number and an expensive calendar featuring spectacular Roman ruins might be thinking of going there. Whisper saw that it concerned some murder at a hotel called the East Side Inn, not the sort of place he would be staying anytime soon to judge by the grainy photos attached to the police crime report, and was about to lay it aside. Then he stopped. The eye for detail that he had developed as a young man when analyzing spy photos of Soviet military installations had never left him. By habit, he always looked deep into the background of any shot, and now he was looking at a man barely visible in the shadows of a murder scene. Whisper knew him. Even in the photo, he seemed to be a man apart, just watching, as he had probably spent half his life doing. Whisper stared at the image of me for a long time, thinking, then pressed a button on his desk, summoning his special assistant. A man in his late 20s, well-tailored and ambitious, entered almost immediately.
I want you to find a man, Whisper told him. I don't know what name he uses now, but for a long time he called himself Scott Murdoch.
The special assistant looked at the photo Whisper pushed across the desk, the face in the background carefully circled. Who is he? He asked.
Years back, he was known as the Rider of the Blue. He was probably the best intelligence agent there's ever been.
The special assistant smiled. I thought that was you.
So did I, Whisperer replied, until I met him.
Chapter 51. The crowd had started to arrive early, streaming into the largest auditorium on the campus of New York University. Frankly, I didn't think the room would be big enough to hold them all. It was the first day of Ben Bradley's long-planned symposium, the Davos Forum for Investigators and the technicians who worked in the pit lane on their behalf. They came from 20 different countries, even a two-man delegation from the Bosnian Police Department who didn't speak English but had convinced someone in authority that they should attend. By all accounts, they were having a whale of a time in New York, and over early morning coffee, they communicated to Bradley their support for making it an annual event. They suggested holding the next one in Vegas. After Bradley's welcoming address, in which he recounted some of his own experiences on 9/11, including the plight of the guy in the wheelchair, conveniently omitting the part about how he had saved him, he was given a large round of applause. That was the cue for him to introduce a hitherto unknown colleague who had assisted Jude Garrett on so many of his investigations. In other words, I was on. Thanks to Battle Boy and the databases he had manipulated, I was now Peter Campbell again. When I had visited him in old Japan to ask for help with the new identity, I asked if he could make the new identity convincing, given that we only had limited time. He nodded.
We've got one huge advantage. People believe what they see in databases. They've never learned the most important rule of cyberspace. Computers don't lie, but liars can compute.
I laughed. Is that why you're so good? You're a gold-plated liar?
In a way, I guess I believe in alternative realities. Look around, I live in one. I suppose they're one big lie. I've never said this to anyone, he continued, but in a fair fight, I'm better than your buddies at the FBI or any of those secret agency guys. You see, to them, alternative realities or cyberspace is just a job. Because I'm big and unattractive, it's different. I don't like the real world much.
He indicated the racks of hard drives.
This is my life.
Funny, I replied. I've never thought of you as big or unattractive. I've always thought of you as Japanese. I saw from his face how much it meant to him. You're probably right, though, I continued, about being the best. I'll tell you this, if I ever got into a tight corner and needed computer help, you'd be the guy I'd call. He laughed and finished his cup of tea.
You want to start?
By the time I left, Peter Campbell was a graduate of the University of Chicago, who went on to study medicine at Harvard and then spent years helping Garrett with his research. As I had planned earlier, Campbell was the one who had found the manuscript of Garrett's remarkable book, and because I had access to his meticulously kept files, the publisher had asked me to edit it. As a result, I had an encyclopedic knowledge of all his cases. I mean, it was almost as if I had investigated them myself. So when, as Peter Campbell, I stood up in front of the congregation of my peers, I started nervously but quickly found my groove. I talked about Garrett's reclusive nature, how I was one of the few friends he had had, and the fact that, essentially, he lived a double life. While everyone knew he was an agent with the FBI, most of his work was for agencies in what I coyly termed the intelligence sphere. I expanded on a number of those investigations, the ones featured prominently in the book, and when I thought I had caught their interest, I opened the cases up to discussion and questions. The place exploded. I have to say, I sort of began to enjoy it. It's a weird thing to stand on a stage and hear your peers attack, analyze, and praise you. A bit like reading your own obituary. There was a woman in a turquoise shirt sitting at the front who led the charge, dissecting evidence, analyzing motive, and asking pointed questions. She had a good mind and an even more attractive face, hair with a natural kick, high cheekbones, and eyes that always seemed close to laughter. At one point she said,
I noticed a few things he wrote in the text. I don't think he liked women very much, did he?
Where did she get that idea? I was under the impression that I liked women very much. To the contrary, I told her. Furthermore, when he did venture out, women seemed to find him extremely charming and, I don't think I'm being indiscreet, very sexually attractive. She barely blinked.
Charming, smart, and sexy?
God, I would have liked to have met him, she said, to a huge round of applause and cheering. As I grinned at her, I realized that all the months of reaching for normal might be achieving something. And I was attracted enough to hope that later in the day I might find the chance to talk to her and ask for her number. In the meantime, I changed gear. I told them about a case which, were Jude alive, he probably would have found the most interesting of all. I told them about the day the towers fell and the murder at the East Side Inn. Ben Bradley spoke earlier about the man in a wheelchair, I said. What he didn't tell you was this. He was the one who led the group that carried the guy down. There was a moment of shocked silence in the auditorium, then a rolling wave of applause for him. Ben and Marcy, she was sitting next to him, stared at me in surprise. Until then, they had no idea that I knew about Ben's bravery, but I think they understood then why I had agreed to speak.
"He didn't find Jesus at all," Marcy said to her husband, feigning surprise.
"No, we should have realized he'd learned the truth. He's a damn investigator,"
Bradley said, berating himself, getting to his feet to acknowledge the crowd. When the clapping stopped, I continued. But that was a day full of remarkable events. Ben's was just one of them. Earlier in the morning, a young woman was running late for work. As she approached the towers, she saw the first plane hit and realized that, as far as the world was concerned, she was already at her desk, as good as dead. For the second time in less than a minute, Bradley was taken aback. I had never shared my theory with him, and he raised his hands as if to say, "Where the hell is this going?" So I told him, and the crowd. You see, the woman whose tardiness had just saved her life wants to kill somebody, and now she's got the perfect alibi. She's dead. So, she walks through the chaos and fear until she finds a place where she can live off the grid and nobody will find her. It's called the East Side Inn. Whenever she goes out, she disguises herself and, on one of those trips, she borrows a textbook. Probably the definitive work on how to kill somebody and how to get away with it. We all know the book. It was Jude Garrett's. That caused a stir, a sharp intake of breath among the delegates. Bradley caught my eye and clapped silently. "Yeah," he was saying, "it was pretty damn good." "She invites a woman, young, probably attractive, to the East Side Inn," I said. "A little drugs, a little sex. Then she kills her date, exactly by the book, so to speak, and disappears. When the NYPD arrive, they find a victim with no face, no fingerprints, and no teeth. So that is what they've got, a victim nobody can identify, and a killer nobody suspects because she's dead. Why the murder? Who are these people? Where's the motive? What does it mean?" I paused and looked around. People were shaking their heads in quiet admiration for the crime. "Yes," I said, "you're right. Impressive." Jude had a name for ones like this. He called them the Mindfuckers. People laughed, and the comments and ideas started slowly but quickly avalanched. By then, however, I was barely listening. I had seen three men enter at the back of the hall and sit silently in the last row. For that reason, when the attractive woman in the turquoise shirt came up with a brilliant idea, I barely registered it. Although I recalled what she had said weeks later, I still cursed myself for not paying attention to it at the time. The only thing I could plead in my defense was that I knew the secret world, and I knew what the men at the back were doing there. They had come for me. Part 3. Chapter 1. The funnel web, native to Australia, is almost certainly the most venomous spider in the world. Worse, even, than the Brazilian wandering spider, and God knows they're bad enough. A long time ago, I investigated a case where the neurotoxin from a funnel web had been used to kill an American engineer, an asset of one of our covert agencies working in Romania. As part of the inquiry, a biologist showed me one of the black full-bodied creatures, a Sydney male, the most venomous and aggressive of the species. I promise you, if you had never seen a spider before, if you didn't know an arachnid from a hole in the ground, the moment you saw a funnel web, you would know you were looking at something deadly. There are men and a few women like that in the secret world. You sense immediately that they haven't been touched by the humanity that inhabits most people. It is one of the reasons I was pleased to leave their environment and chance my hand in the sunlight. It was three of them who were waiting at the back of the auditorium for the session of the forum to end. As soon as the delegates had filed out for lunch, leaving just myself and Bradley at the front,